The following talk was given by Steve Matushak at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on January 22, 2023. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Really nice to see all of you here this morning. I'm going to be giving a talk this morning that I've titled, You Don't Have Time. Though, as I was looking over my talk, I thought maybe a more urgent way of putting it is, I don't have time. So before I get into my talk, though, I just want to say Happy New Year to everyone. It's 2023. It's hard to believe we're already a couple weeks into the new year. And there's something about New Year's. They just have this element to them, this sense of change, that things are going to change. I think it has to do just with that number. It's such an arbitrary thing, but that number is changing. There's a sense that there's going to be change afoot. Of course, there's always change afoot. We just mean whatever it was we didn't like that was going on before isn't going to be happening anymore. And I remember the year 2020. People remember 2020? It seems both like it happened a really long time ago and like it just happened. And I remember when 2020 was ending, people were like, I can't wait to see 2020 in the rearview mirror. I'm ready for something new. And then 2021 came along. And as you may remember, at least right at the beginning of the year, people were like, oh my goodness, what was I wishing for? So it is a time of change, New Year's are. And it's a time that people often make resolutions because they sense that it's a time of change. Now, I just want to, before I talk a little bit about New Year's resolutions, just want to say that I used to do them. One of the resolutions I used to make every year for a while was to quit smoking. And if anyone has gone through that tremendous challenge of quitting smoking, you know that, you know, it's just every year I seem to be making the, this is the year I'm going to stop smoking. So in college, I just decided that all resolutions really were yet another thing for me to fail at. So I said, I'm not going to make any more New Year's resolutions. I'm just going to take care of my life. If smoking happens to cease this year, great. And, you know, I was doing things to try to make that happen. I wasn't just sort of magically wishing it would just suddenly stop. But resolutions, I determined, were something that I couldn't do. It just seemed like I gave them up all the time. And then I'd beat myself up for giving up my New Year's resolutions. But there's something about New Year's resolutions that I think is important. And that is, if you think about what they are, they have within them a sense that the way things have been going, the old way, business as usual, isn't really quite working, right? So they have at the heart of them the sense that something's not working right. And so let's try something new. Let's do something new. But it's how we then go about doing that that again causes problems for us, because we'll do the usual thing where we roll up our sleeves and go, okay, and we get our hands nice and dirty, trying to tinker around the thing that's broken and get it to be exactly the way we want it to be. And there we are back at where we started from. Different set of problems, but then we're making New Year's resolutions all over again. Now, there are things, of course, you need to roll up your sleeves and get your hands in there and get dirty and do the work. And that'd be something like fixing a drain, you know. First, you pour your Drano in and that doesn't work. And then, I don't know. If you're like me, you just call somebody to take care of it for you. The last time we took care of our pipes at home, the entire apparatus under our sink just sort of fell apart. And then I'm almost embarrassed to say it, but we used something that's akin to duct tape to try to hold it all together until we got a real person to come in. And he looked at it and he goes, well, somebody just taped this all together. And I was like, I won't tell him that that was me. But anyhow, there are things that you do need to, you know, roll up your sleeves and get in there and fix and work at. But when we're talking about ourselves, and that's the thing we're talking about, then you want to watch it. Then you want to be vigilant. What is it that you're doing? What is it that's taking place? But still, in that sense of promise that there's going to be change in the new year, we may very well have a sense that the new year doesn't have to be the old year anew. In other words, we do have a sense in there that we don't have to just go about and engage in business as usual and end up at the end of the year where we started the year. That as we can realize that changing doesn't have to be changing, and I put quotation marks around that, because changing, the stuff we usually do where we roll up our sleeves and get in and we try to alter things the way we want to, fundamentally leaves us unchanged. And we end up, just like I said, being in the same spot we were. We're merely tinkering. This leads me to a term that I encountered in a book by Charlotte Joko Beck. And Charlotte Joko Beck is a Zen Roshi from the 20th century, lived in California, and has a few books out that collect her teachings. And this particular collection is called Everyday Zen. And she talks about something she calls turning points. And turning points came to mind to me, actually, as I was thinking about the new year. My talk actually came from something I'll be talking about at the end of the talk. So I had this little note for myself about not having time. And it just started to get me to think about the new year. And that reminded me about Charlotte Joko Beck's teaching on turning points. She happens to link turning points to the new year. So, of course, it would pop to my mind. She wrote, "As we approach the new year, we sense that the holiday season is a time of turning. And no human being can take that turning lightly. We have only a certain number of turning years on the planet." So that time of turning, she calls that a turning point. That's a point at which things can turn, things can change. It's a pivot point. And what she's talking about particularly in these turning points, again, isn't our usual sense of, well, I'm just going to, you know, I play video games too much. I'm not going to play video games. It's not that. It's actually this pivot that we're talking about. This is a, if you think about how a pivot works, it's right here, and then the whole thing revolves around it. And this pivot point, this turning point, is from how we usually conceive things to seeing that our conceptions don't hold water, so to speak. So that turning point, these pivot points, are in the realization that how we're conceiving things, how we're packaging experience, don't work, don't make sense. And we can actually see through the confusion that is our usual way of packaging the world. And it calls to mind this phrase in a text that we chant here at Dharma Field that I'm sure many of you are familiar with. If you come on Friday evenings, you probably chanted it. And if you've come on Friday evenings, they chant to let you know that they're going to be chanting this particular text. They chant the Japanese title of it, excuse me, Hukan Zazengi, which sounds like to me like some kind of dish. I don't know what sort of food you'd have. But, and so you hear somebody saying, Hukan Zazengi, and then everyone starts chanting this text. Hukan Zazengi just means universal recommendations for sitting meditation. Kind of doesn't sound as interesting when you hear the English translation, but it actually just gets to the heart of what it is. And in that text, the author of the text, who's Dogen, 13th century Buddhist monk who brought Soto Zen, the Zen that we practice here at Dharma Field, from China to Japan. When he came back from China to Japan, the story is that he wrote this Hukan Zazengi, Universal Recommendations for Sitting Meditation. And he says in there, "You have gained the pivotal opportunity of human form. Do not use your time in vain." The pivotal opportunity of human form. We humans have this great skill at confusing ourselves. Really great skill coming up with all these ideas about what it is that's going on and then getting caught up in them and not seeing what's really going on. And then having the skill to see through that and to wake up to what's really taking place. So humans have that pivotal opportunity of human form. Humans do this. So to be in this human form is to have that pivotal opportunity. Now, a challenge for us is that sometimes we don't show up as humans. Sometimes we show up in other ways. You know, there's six realms of being. That's a teaching of Buddhism. And you can think of those realms of beings as realms of consciousness or realms of understanding. And one, for example, that might be unusual to people is the realm of the hungry ghosts. And if you've ever seen pictures of the hungry ghosts, they're these figures with long extruded lips, really long, thin necks, big bellies. The thing is, they're always hungry, and they can't ever get enough food in there, you know, with those long lips and the thin throat. They're always hungry, never sated. So we could be there in that realm. Then we don't have that pivotal opportunity yet because we're caught up in our craving. We're caught up in our desire. We're in a hell, in a way, unable to sate this desire we have. There's always something we don't have. But when we're in the human realm, we do this thing where we kind of get caught up in our conceptions and we can spin that around and wake up. So at any moment, we have that opportunity. And Dogen says, do not use your time in vain. That's what Joko Beck was saying. She says, we only have a certain number of turning years on the planet. And I think for some people, at first, when you hear something like that, it's panic time. I only have so many years. But this is, again, then, don't waste your time in vain. That is actually, do it now. Take care of it now. Don't put it off till tomorrow. I'm very good at procrastinating. I was telling somebody, you know, for many years, I struggled with anxiety. And for many of those many years, I didn't know that's what I was struggling with. And one of the ways I would deal with my anxiety would be to procrastinate. And sometimes what I realized about procrastination is whatever it was that I wasn't doing, if I got to the point where I couldn't do it anymore, all of that energy and pain that was causing me to procrastinate, it just vanished. It was just like, wow, this feels really good. And so it would encourage me to procrastinate. Now, of course, the bad part of that is I think about the time a friend of mine visited me when I was an undergraduate student at the University of Minnesota. So a friend of mine comes from out of state, traveled hundreds of miles to see me. And I had procrastinated on the final project of my theater set design course. And I had to design a play and create a model for my design in what would be about 8 or 9 hours. And so I was up all night. And that's the thing that procrastination did for me. But I'm talking about that, you know, that sense we have that we don't have enough time. We can actually just do it now. We don't have to procrastinate. Procrastination is just another thing that we do to avoid some of the stuff I'll be talking about here. So this turning point then is where we can pivot from confusion to awareness, from business as usual, and I could even say busyness as usual. Because we don't just, when we say business as usual, we might be thinking, well, I got to take care of stuff. Well, you do have to take care of stuff. But how much stuff do you have to take care of? Just watch your life, how much of that, of how much you're doing is busyness. But this pivot, this turning point is from our business as usual to a new way of doing things, which is actually the old way of doing things, the natural way, before we get caught up in our conceptions of the world. So we're actually pivoting in a way back to where we started from. Now, Beck talks about something she calls a crucial turning point. And I was really struck by this phrase. And she says a crucial turning point is when, in feeling dukkha, and dukkha is that sense of unease, that unsettledness that makes us go out and be busy, that makes us want something that's not here, that makes us go out looking for something, that brings about this craving to fill some hole that we feel. So she says that when in feeling that, we can reach a crucial turning point when we don't just keep doing what we usually do, which is rearranging the deck chairs on a sinking ship. But instead, we look to ourselves. We look to ourselves and what we're doing. And I liked that image of deck chairs. I had rearranging furniture until I started thinking about that other familiar image of the deck chairs on a sinking ship. Because there, you've got a sense of what's really going on. You know, if you're on a sinking ship, you get the sense, oh, something's off. Now, granted, if it was like the Titanic and was pointing that way, you'd know pretty fast what it was that was going on. But if they're just, you've got this sense in your gut that something is wrong, and then you go, it's got to be the, look at the chairs are just sort of higgledy-piggledy. If I put them in a right order, this feeling's going to go away, not knowing that just moving those chairs around is not going to take care of what it is that's causing this feeling. So I like that image because that's what we do. We feel something is seriously going on, something that is, you know, calls your attention. And then what we do to take care of it is we move the furniture around. We just sort of rearrange the deck chairs on that sinking ship. But what Beck says is this crucial turning point is where we start to realize that's what we're doing. And we start to look at ourselves. Why am I doing that? Who am I in a way? What am I doing here? And there's something about that phrase, crucial turning point, that was interesting to me, that stopped me. Because if you know the word crucial, of course, we know a crucial moment would be one that's decisive or a critical moment. But the etymology of crucial is crux or cruce, as in crucify, which means cross. And a crucial moment is at the fork of a crossroad. In other words, it's a turning point. It's a place where we can turn in another direction. So what Beck is saying is that the cessation of merely rearranging those deck chairs and looking at what we're doing is a turning point where we can arrive at a turning point of seeing what reality is. In other words, it's crucial for us first to realize the error. Error might be too strong of a word, but to actually realize what we're doing. The confusion might be a better way to put it of what it is. We got to do that first. We have to really see that we're getting caught up in ideas about what's going on. And we're not really seeing what's going on. And so we're going about this the wrong way. Then we are making those New Year's resolutions that we're going to have to make again at the beginning of the next year. This is what Dogen, the monk, that a 13th century monk I mentioned earlier, talks about in a passage that gets quoted a lot here at Dharma Field, and I was almost hesitant to quote it, but it's such a great quote. And we're beginning a new year. Why not hear it again? It's from a text that we call often Genjo Koan, so another Japanese title, and it's The Realization of Ultimate Reality. Now, that one sounds a little more fascinating than Universal Recommendation for Sitting Meditation. So Realization of Ultimate Reality. What I was just talking about, that starting to realize, that crucial turning point that Beck's talking about, is to start to realize that how we put things together isn't quite right, and then to look at ourselves and see what it is we're doing, is what Dogen talks about when he says to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. And that's the part I always remember. Then it keeps going. To forget the self is to be verified by all things. To be verified by all things is to let one's body and mind and the body and minds of others drop off. All traces of enlightenment come to rest, and this rest carries on without end. So, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. And the Buddha way is this practice that we have where perhaps we're going to say, look, I know something's wrong out here. Something is not working. The way I've constructed the world, the way I go about my business as usual is not right. Oh, there's this way, the Eightfold Path. There's the middle way. If I take this up, well, what are you going to do? You're going to study yourself. You're going to look at what is it that you're doing? How are you responding to the situation at hand? That's what's important. We always look out at the world and blame the things that seem to be showing up for us. That's the reason I am this way. Without just looking at how are you responding? How are you reacting to what it is that's showing up? So we study the self. And to study the self, once you really start to look at that self, you start to go, who is it exactly I'm talking about? You know, you start to realize that self doesn't have the kind of substance, doesn't have the kind of solidity that we just, by default, assume that it has. We don't even think about it. It's just there. If We do everything out of it. And once we start to study it, we start to go, well, where is it exactly? Where is the self? And then we start to let go of acting out of that conception of self. And that's to forget the self. And to forget the self is to be verified by all things, to realize that all beings, the universe, is showing up as this moment that you've been labeling self. To be verified by all things is to let one's body and mind and the body of minds and others drop off. So you don't see the way you usually see things as you here being separate from the rest of the world. All of this drops away and you start to realize that we're all actualizing or realizing totality, that we're all together, the seemingly separate reality that we're in. All traces of enlightenment come to rest, and this rest carries on without end. And all that's telling us is that we might hear teachings. You are already enlightened, but maybe you haven't heard that. You will hear that if you encounter Zen teaching, that you are already enlightened. That's where you are. And so when we are confused, it feels like it's someplace else to go. Here I am rearranging those deck chairs. How do I stop this? We might think there's something that's going to help me see what's really the problem, and that is enlightenment. When you finally realize it, it's just this. There's no thing that is enlightenment. So all the traces of enlightenment come to rest. So that's in this crucial turning point. I think what Beck is helping us to see is that it's turning to study the self, and in studying the self, then we get to the turning point of being able to see through our conceptualizations. So when we see that we don't have to do business as usual, then we realize what Dogen tells us in his Universal Recommendations for Sitting Meditation. Don't waste your time. Do not use your time in vain. Now we hear something like that, do not use your time in vain. And I know this because I looked at a book that kind of did something like this, and we might go, okay, so I only have so much time. So now the next step is to come up with a to-do list in which I prioritize the things that I really need to do. So the most important to the least important things. When we hear, do not waste our time in vain, that's what we want to do. We want to go, okay, well, what's the stuff that I really need to take care of? But just know that not wasting your time in vain is not about creating a list of things to do, even though it may feel like that. Now, granted, again, you know, you've got a day coming up and you've got, I don't know, 20 things that need to be taken care of. I've done this. You come up with, what are the things I need to do? What are the things that need to be done in the next hour? Okay, go ahead and do that. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about not wasting your time in vain. You don't need to come up with a list of things to do and a list of things not to do, but rather you just look at how are you doing whatever it is you're doing. Are you doing it mindlessly? No. Come up with examples. We know lots of things we can do mindlessly, including driving our cars. So when I would teach meditation instruction, which I haven't done for a while, but when I would teach meditation instruction, one of the things I would talk about is that act of driving our cars, because it can be very helpful. So I would drive on a highway, and I had a long drive. It was like a half-hour drive, and went through downtown. When I was approaching downtown, roughly at rush hour, I had to pay attention. People, if I may be allowed this, people are crazy. You know, so they were just going like 70 miles an hour, and they were changing lanes in packed traffic with no shoulders because I'm going up 35W, right? And I'm going, this is nuts. So I had to pay attention. I just had to watch what was going on. But once I got past downtown, it was like multiple lanes of highway. And nobody was on the highway. And then I could just do what we usually think of as drive, which is just, I don't know, next thing I knew, my exit was there. And every once in a while, I'd be way in the wrong lane. I'd have to go, oh, my exit's here, and go all the way over. How often do we do that kind of thing in our life? You know, you just kind of wake up to what it is that's taking place all of a sudden. And what's interesting is if you notice, something like driving really helps you see this, yet you still were driving. So where were you exactly? This is how we go through our life. Well, you just did that thing, but were you actually tending to the thing you were just doing? So were you doing it mindlessly or were you doing it mindfully, being fully present, fully attentive to what it is that's showing up as the activity that you're doing? Are you engaging in what you're doing unwholesomely or wholesomely? So unwholesomely is we got it figured out. We know how things are and that's the way things are. And we may not put it that way, but it's just the way that we go through the world. We have an understanding and that's the way we do things. And that is unwholesome. Now, does that mean it's bad? No, it just means it's unwholesome. It's not of the whole. Are we aware that we're acting unwholesomely or wholesomely? And if we're aware of our unwholesomeness, now we've got our unwholesomeness in the picture and we're starting to come back to wholesomeness. If that sounds kind of kooky to you, the way I can describe it to you, if you have a sitting meditation practice, partly what my talk is about, if you have a sitting meditation practice and you find you are lost in thought, what our teaching is, well, return to the breath is what we say. Now, that's a little tricky because when I started meditation practice, and I think a lot of people when they start this practice, when they hear return to the breath, what they hear is when you start thinking, kick the thought out of your head and start focusing on the breathing. But that's not it at all. And as you do this, you start to have a lighter touch. At first, you kind of do that. You do things like, there I go again. I'm thinking again. You know, that's going to happen so often after a while, you just get tired of saying it to yourself. You're going to realize, to be human is to think. Is this going to be taking place? And as you think, to be human is to latch onto that train for a little while. So you can just wake up to the fact that you've done that, that you're doing that. So there's that unwholesome, you didn't even know what you were doing, to now you're aware. And in that awareness, guess what? Your breath is there. Unless somehow you're somebody who doesn't breathe. So I guess I'd make you like a zombie or a vampire or something like that. But unless you're just a human, there's that breath. And now there it is. And it's, if you're paying attention to the whole wholesomeness, the whole picture, breath is just right there. It's just right there. Just part of what it is that's showing up. So are you acting wholesomely, unwholesomely or wholesomely? In acting wholesomely, you think about what Dogen was talking about. Wholesome is of the whole. That is everything. It's, you know, it's not intellectually knowing every single thing. People might think that too, but instead it's just realizing that anything that's showing up is all beings. It's all things showing up. So when we act wholesomely, it's to be verified by all things, what Dogen was talking about. When we act and we see what it is we're doing, we can see that the activities that are unwholesome resolve themselves. So another thing people think they have to do is maybe come up with a list of unwholesome things and not engage in those things. Because there are teachings that will tell you not to, what is the word they use? I want to say not to bring about unwholesome, you know, activities. There's a better way to put that. But my brain is not allowing me to do that. And so people think, okay, well, I've got to figure out what those unwholesome activities are. But again, you don't have to do that. Unwholesome activities will be revealed to you as unwholesome activities when you shine the light of your attention on them. You're going to realize, oh, that's not what's really going on. That's just what I think is going on. And again, how often does that happen to us where we think we really know what's going on and maybe we get outraged by it? And then we find out that's not really what was going on. I was talking to somebody about this thing where you think perhaps a friend of yours is mad at you for some reason. And you start running through, oh, now why is she mad at me? What on earth did I do that? I mean, I don't understand this. So then you kind of go, okay, well, as we were talking about that movie that I hated, and she loved that movie, and I guess we kind of had some crosswords on that. You know, now that I think about it, my impression when we were having that conversation is that she doesn't value my opinions. And now that I think about it, she always thinks I'm wrong about, you know, and then you, that's why she's not talking to me, because she thinks I'm a moron. And I don't, you know, and then you meet the person and that's not at all what was going on. Maybe they were on vacation and you never heard from them because they were out having fun in Hawaii or whatever the deal is. That happens a lot when we do that. We construct the whole world from our ideas about it. It's unwholesome. We have a view from which we're seeing it. And it usually, the thing we're thinking about isn't even there. And sometimes it is there, but we're not seeing it. We're seeing the overlay, our ideas on top of it. So unwholesome activities then will resolve themselves. They'll reveal themselves if we're looking closely at what it is we're doing. And then once we do that, when you're engaged in unwholesome activity, just ask yourself, do you just keep doing it? Do I, even though I just saw my friend again now and I realize everything's good between us, do I still sit there and go, why is she mad at me? I mean, it doesn't even make sense, because now you know that the thing you believe to be true is not true. So when you see unwholesome activities for what they are, you can at least see them for what they are. And odds are, if it's something that is just harmful or isn't helping matters at all, you probably are just going to let it go off to the side. Now, you might say, but Steve, I engage in unwholesome activities all the time. Well, we all do from time to time. So you, what are you in this moment? What is showing up at this moment? In the moment, if you're engaging in unwholesome activities, you really don't see what it is that's showing up as unwholesome. Even if you tell yourself, I know that's unwholesome. But if you find yourself engaging in it, you don't know that in your heart. You don't truly understand that. You know, it's like death, where we say, well, I know I'm going to die. But do we live really out of an understanding of that? And by that, I don't mean running around in a state of panic, right? Somebody was, I don't remember what, it was a poet. Oh, I know, it was Ron Padgett, the poet Ron Padgett. He said something like, you know, there's a saying that people have, live as if this is the last day of your life. And then he goes, what? If I was living like this is the last day of my life, I'd be running around like a kangaroo with boxing gloves on, trying to like fend off whatever it was that was coming my way. He goes, what people really mean when they say live life as if it's your last day on earth is just to, you know, to fully live your life, to enjoy your life. In other words, to live life as if you're a kangaroo without boxing gloves. I like that poem. So I'm not talking about that in living out of a sense of death. It's not panic, but rather it's this idea of about how much time we have. Do we really think about that? And I think most of us live kind of luxuriantly, you know, thinking, well, it's not going to happen yet. So I'm going to do one more word search puzzle, just because I got time. You know, I'm reading a book right now called Being Mortal by Atul Gawande. And in it, he talks about his father, who was a very busy man. He was a doctor, but he did all these other things. And how when his father, it was discovered he had a tumor in his spinal column, and it was tremendously large. And it was something that they didn't really think they were going to be able to get rid of, but they thought they could cut some of it down. When he had mortality facing him, his son noticed that the dad, what was important for the father, changed. So again, thinking about this unwholesomeness and whether or not we engage in it. When the father saw death right there, he devoted himself to his relationships with other people, to his grandchildren, his children, and his wife, taking care of his life and his home. That was it. It was just that. But whenever it looked like the tumor, like they could deal with the tumor, and it was no longer mortality staring at him, then he would kind of stretch out a little, and he would start adding more things to it. Right? So the question about the unwholesome activities we engage in, are we really tasting what it is that we're doing? And it's okay if we don't. It just notice that. If you know intellectually, yeah, this is unwholesome, and you're still doing it, are you really seeing the situation for what it is? And that gets me back to New Year's resolutions. So I was going to loop back to that. And I want to tie that in actually with meditation practice. Because I think one of the things that ends up on people's resolution list is I'm going to meditate, or I'm going to meditate more, whatever it is. And what comes along with that notion, all right, this year I'm going to put in more time on a cushion, or you know what, I never got around to meditating, this is the year I'm going to meditate. What comes along with that is I don't have time to sit. That is part of that promise. I don't have time to sit. I'm not saying that you necessarily even think that right now, but when it's you stop doing it again, because it's one of those resolutions where you're rolling your sleeves up and you're getting, you know, when you realize that you're not sitting or you're not sitting as often anymore, again, it's because you don't have time for it. I don't have time to sit. And I would say, and this is what was the instigation for my whole talk. If that's what you're telling yourself, I don't have time to sit, exclamation point. I don't have time to sit, might be the best way to put it. That is precisely when you must sit. That is precisely when you must sit, when you don't have time to sit. And first of all, we're thinking, I don't have time to sit because my life is so busy, because of this busyness I was talking about. Yeah, you have time to sit. You have time to sit. Now, it's possible life can be busy. I've been there. I think we've all been at those points in our life. But when you are so busy, you know, look closely at what it is you're doing. And I still, the busiest moment of my life outside of graduate school, I think, is when I was teaching at a community college full time. And that was a 40 plus hour a week job. And I was coming to the Zen Center, and I was sitting a pretty full schedule coming to classes. And then I was also a dramaturg, which is like a research assistant on theater productions. And it was like, I remember somebody looking at me going, you're really doing a lot of stuff. And I just thought, yeah, I'm doing a lot of stuff. That's all I was doing at every waking moment was stuff. And it meant I didn't have to deal with anything that was of any importance. Now, a lot of my emotional energy went into the stuff I was doing, meaning freaking out and getting angry. It was all happening at the stuff because I was really keeping myself busy. So when your life is so busy, you don't have time to sit, just take a look at it for a moment. Are you really busy? Are there really things that need taken care of, or are you just trying not to notice that unrest, that uneasiness that's at the heart of your life? Again, think about that ship that's sinking. Do you sense the ship is sinking? And now you're just out there rearranging those deck chairs. We have difficulties sitting with this. Just know this. That what Steve Hagen calls deep ache of the heart. Think about that. Deep ache of the heart. It says so much, but it tells you about that. It's a deep ache. Who wants to sit with that? So that's where we get up. We start moving around. That deep ache might show up as just boredom, you know, sitting. And you got to do something because you're not looking again now at what is the feeling that's arising, what is really showing up. So Steve Hagen quotes Blaise Pascal at the beginning of his book, Meditation Now or Never. And Frank, I don't know if you're here, but we had a student stay with us last week, visiting us from out of town. And I was looking for this quote, and I was like, I think it's at the beginning of this book. And I looked, and it wasn't there. And I was, I think it's at the beginning of this book. And I looked, and I went through all of Steve Hagen's books until I finally went, well, it's got to be Meditation Now or Never. But we didn't have it on our bookshelves out there, so I couldn't read it to him. So I did my usual thing, which is I got it wrong. I just kind of, well, it's something like this, but it's better. Here it is. Blaise Pascal said, I've discovered that all human evil comes from this. Man's being unable to sit still in a room. Let me think about that. So that busyness, is it what Pascal is talking about, that there's just something there that we're aware of, but we don't want to pay attention to. And so we do other things. And that disquiet, that unrest remains there. That sense that something is off remains there because we're just rearranging the deck furniture. So do you not have time because of that? And I tell you that if that's the case, if you're just keeping busy, you don't have to do what you're doing, you must sit. You need to sit and look at that. Second, I want you to notice something if you say, I don't have time. Look at what, I don't have time to sit. I sort of showed my hand. But look at what you're saying when you say, I don't have time to sit. You're really saying, I don't have time. That's an insight. That is an insight. I don't have time. That is, don't waste your time in vain. You see that? I don't have time to sit is actual awareness that you don't have time. So get to it. Don't waste your time in vain. Now, I want to share with you a story, and this is just from my memory. So again, I'm going to alter it a little bit because of my terrible memory. People can say something to me and I have to repeat it back to them within a half a minute and I get the words wrong. You know, I still kind of screw the words up. But I remember this story. It was told at our Rohatsu, which is one of our meditation retreats we have here at Dharma Field. And it's the one that we observe in December. And it's in observance of the awakening of the Buddha. So it's a longer meditation retreat. And this particular year, it was co-taught by Cynthia Scott, who's a Zen teacher in town and was a student of at Dharma Field back when I first started. And she tells a story about her, another teacher she had, Diane Martin, teacher that she got her Dharma transmission from. And her teacher, Diane Martin, studied with Suzuki Roshi back in the 1960s. So she was back there at the beginning of all that. And she did some sitting and she really saw, for lack of a better term, the value of it. Like she saw that this was important. And she was kind of distraught because she did not have time to do it. She had a family, children. She had a job. And there's just no time in her day to do this. And so she met with Suzuki Roshi and she told him, Roshi, I don't have time to do this. I don't have time to sit. And his answer was so incredible, as is true of Suzuki Roshi. If you look at his teachings, he was really, truly a great teacher. And he asked her, he said, you get out of bed in the morning, don't you? She was kind of startled by that. And he said, between sitting up and putting your foot on the floor, there is your zazen. There is your practice. And so while she was too busy to go to the meditation hall and sit, between sitting up in the morning and putting your foot on the floor was her practice. And that kept her practice going until she could finally get back to the sitting and the sesshins. And now she's a Dharma transmitted teacher teaching. And I found that to be a very moving story, about I don't have time to sit. When we're talking about sitting, we're talking about being mindful. Every moment we have the opportunity. So you can find that time. If you feel your schedule really is so full, like Ms. Martin's was, Roshi Martin, that you just don't have time for this. There's a time there. You have time. Don't waste your time in vain. What do you usually do between sitting up and putting your foot on the floor? I don't want to get up. It's Monday again. Or you start running through everything. No, now is the time to just zazen right there. So just think about that. I don't have time. It's true. You don't have time. So don't waste it. And if I were to put that another way, in other words, sit. And that's where I'm going to end my talk. I don't know if people have questions or comments, but I would welcome them. Well, thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.